Off the afternoon session is Dr. David Green, who is a professor at McGill University and the director of the Redpath Museum. He obtained his undergraduate degree in zoology from UBC, and he earned both his master's and PhD in zoology from Guelph. His research on amphibians ranges from genetics to functional morphology to evolutionary ecology, covering a wide gamut. Though in recent years he's pursued particular interest in species at risk, he's been heavily involved in the science and management aspect of that, and declining amphibian populations, which will be the subject of this talk, including the determinants of species ranges and population declines, population dynamics, dispersal, recruitment, and so on. And one of the centerpieces of his research is his long-term study of the ecology of an endangered group called Fowler's Toads at Long Point, Ontario, which now exceeds 25 years of data collection and study. So, Dr. David Green.
Thanks for the nice introduction, Tony. I'll remember that the next salary policy comes around. So, we heard a lot of theoretical talks this morning about aspects of biodiversity loss and distribution and evolutionary aspects. I'm going to get practical, and I want to talk about a practical problem, and the way in which I want to approach it is as much sociological among scientists as it is the science itself. How does a group of scientists, a global community of scientists, approach a problem in ecology and seek to solve it amidst an atmosphere where there are scientists are competing with each other for money and prestige and papers in Nature and the usual things that scientists compete for. And I'm going to also be mentioning this toad that Tony mentioned. This is Fowler's toad that figures very prominently in my research these days and the long-term study that I've been doing, which has gone on for over a quarter of a century, through combination of dogged determination and a certain lack of imagination to do anything else. So about 25 years ago, and I remember it, we didn't really understand as much about amphibian populations as we do today by a long shot. It was at that time that at the first World Congress of Herpetology that amphibian biologists gathered together to meet really very globally for the first time and swap stories like you do over beer, and came to realize that the same story came appearing over and over again in from different parts of the world. That somebody had gone to a site where they knew a species occurred and couldn't find that species anymore. Excuse me. Can you get me? Sorry about that. So people realized that the animals that they knew about and knew where to find weren't there anymore and began to speculate that perhaps amphibian populations were declining worldwide. And if they are declining, then what is it that's making it do that? And how can we figure out what is behind it, if these declines really are global or not, and how can we alleviate that? And since that time, there's been a tremendous amount of research on amphibian populations. And these are just a few of the books that have appeared since then. There are more on the way. And hundreds and hundreds of papers on amphibian ecology, population biology. So that we're now to a stage where we know enough about the animals that we're beginning to understand the extent of our ignorance about them, which is a lot of progress. And also put amphibians on in consciousness of people generally in society. Amphibians are now okay. People like amphibians now, which is unusual and for someone who grew up ever so long ago as I did, when frogs and toads were considered uncool and icky, kind of like me. All of these species are on the Canadian Endangered Species List. They're all there because I had a hand in putting them there. as part of CSEWIC, which assesses endangerment status. And the idea of that arose at in the early days of studying declining amphibian populations arose out of the concerns about the ecology of the animals. And I'm going to put up here this definition that of what a decline is. It's important to know what you're looking for. That was put out by Jim Vile and Saylor in 1993, early on in this great research initiative. And they define a population decline as a downward trend in numbers within populations over an appropriate span of time in excess of normal fluctuations in population size. It's a very specific definition. It's really a population biology demographic definition. And it requires that you know a couple things. First thing you need to know is what's normal. And then you have to know what's not in order to figure it out. And at the time, nobody can answer either part of this definition. It takes a lot of time and a lot of effort. And what people wanted to do and wanted to find out were to have, you know, quick fixes if they could find them. What is killing off amphibians? And not really paid attention, a lot of attention, to this particular kind of approach and to see how they could solve this problem. Now, I took this definition kind of seriously. And at the time, I was working on, beginning to work on a project on these toads at Long Point, Ontario. This is what Long Point looks like. And over here is Lake Erie. Over on this side are the marshes. The toads hibernate in the dunes. They sing in the spring over here. And they spend the summers on the beach. Not a bad lifestyle. And in the spring, in approximately 1 month from now, the toads will come out and they'll begin to sing. Here's what they sound like. There we go. I hope you could hear that. And another one. So remember that the Congress of Herpetology was in 1989, and the meetings to establish the Declining Populations Task Force, the Global Task Force, occurred in the early 90s. And at that time, here I am catching toads, and I had some data. And my first several years of data about the abundance of males at this particular site on Lake Erie looked like that, which is a bit embarrassing because my animals were obviously going up and bucking the trend altogether. Okay. So the task force and people who are interested in amphibians called up the usual cast of characters, you know, the usual suspects for what is it that are could be contributing to the decline of amphibian populations. And we've heard of all of these things this morning, all these various things. And people hit upon one after another of these to try to see if they were really the cause of amphibian declines. One of the first to be made a great deal of news about was UV radiation, because UVB radiation is mutagenic, it damages DNA, and it may possibly lead to declines. And the first data that came out from Andy Blaustein in Oregon in the early 90s showed this sort of thing, where if these are different frogs, this is a tree frog, which seems to be unaffected, and a toad, and a rannet frog, that if you block out UV in the ponds where you raise the eggs and tadpoles, they do better than if you don't. Ah, UVB is the universal frog killer. However, they later found that, no, it's not, that it's actually the presence of a Saprolegnia fungus. And if the fungus is not present, then they don't die. And the UVB may help the fungus, but it's not the cause. So if you look probe deeper into this, although a lot of news was made, a lot of papers written about UVB, it's not the universal frog killer. There's more to it than meets the eye. Contaminants were looked at, of course. And one of the first to look at was acid precipitation, because low pH is bad for lots of things. Will kill off tadpoles and kill off amphibian eggs. And it was known, at, certainly at that time, that increased industrialization in the eastern U.S. and in northern Europe was acidifying lakes, particularly acidifying lakes that had very little buffering capacity, like in Scandinavia or in the Adirondacks. Actually, as we found out, that amphibians can adapt, and Andrew would like this, they adapt to this, because the minimum tolerable pH of amphibian populations matches very well with the minimum pH they're likely to encounter. And there's good evidence from Scandinavia that amphibian populations will adapt over several generations to lower pH. Besides, it's only very local. So pH is not the frog killer that they were looking for. People were worried about developmental deformities in the 90s. And there were discoveries of frogs that looked like this. This is a Pacific tree frog with, I don't know how many legs, a great many legs. And it's obviously a crazy thing. There was a population of leopard frogs that was looked at. This is quite famously a field trip from a high school. They went to catch frogs, and they found frogs with deformities, a great many deformities, and it freaked them all out. And the teacher reported this to the authorities in Minnesota, who freaked them out. And they all thought that this was going to be some sort of apocalypse. And we looked at the frogs with deformed legs. Of course, in the popular press, it was easy to see these are deformed children. And what is it that's happening to our landscape? And the initial reaction was, ah, it must be chemical contaminants in the environment. And a great deal of money was put into researching this. And you can induce deformities of all sorts in the laboratory using chemical mutagens. One of them is retinoic acid, which is a very powerful teratogen and developmental inducer in low doses. It does the right thing. If you amputate a limb of a developing limb of a tadpole and subject it to retinoic acid, you get these mirror image duplications. You get limbs growing out like that, which is what's happening in this frog here, too. Here's one. Here's two legs joined at the knee, sort of, and mirror images of each other. And so a great deal of money was thrown into this, and Sue Bryant's lab at UC in San Diego started up a very large research project on looking at contaminants and amphibian deformities, until my friend Stan Sessions discovered that also present in these ponds where these deformed frogs were is this trematode parasite. And the parasite drills into the developing limb buds, this nice soft area where they can encyst themselves. And the encysts can physically, mechanically disrupt development. And you can test this. You can put little glass beads in, just like the cysts, and disrupt development. And so this trematode parasite has this complex life cycle, and part of the life cycle, part of the way it gets from the intermediate host, which is a frog, into its ultimate host, which is a bird or a snake, is to render the intermediate host easier to be eaten by forming it like that. So it's useful for the worm. And so is this a product of chemical contaminants, or is it the product of something in nature that we hadn't noticed before because nobody looked before? Because nobody cared about amphibians until only recently. As it happens, there is more evidence that these snails grow better when ponds are eutrophied. And then you get more trematodes, and then you get more deformed frogs. So there's a combination of things, synergy of things. And it's not so simple as would first be thought, one chemical equals one set of deformities. Okay, so back to my study. We're now up into the mid-90s, and I've acquired some students who go out and chase toads for me. And very conveniently, my toads went down, so they declined. So now I'm up to date. We'll leave that for a minute. And look at climate. Climate was the next thing that people looked at. We've heard a lot about climate change and how climate is affecting biotas and species around the world. And it was thought, in particularly in Australia, that a correlation could be found between the losses of some populations of amphibians in Queensland and a rise in temperature at that time. This was put out by Ross Alford. And so that they thought that perhaps this particular frog, this gastric brooding frog in Queensland, went extinct in the 1990s in association with this rise in temperature. And furthermore, Trevor Beebe in southern England noted, as he was standing outside his back door and listening for the frogs that sing in the spring, that the frogs that were there, one toad, an Ajax toad, and two species of frogs, were changing their springtime emergence, the timing of their breeding. We heard about that this morning as well. And he correlated that to rise in temperature and to global warming. I wanted to see if this was true of the toads that I was looking at Long Point, and I couldn't find a correlation. Now, this is some newer data that I have going back from 1988, or 89 actually, to 2012. And can you see a pattern in there? I can't see a pattern in there. So I just realized something, though. You know, this is like 2 weeks ago, literally. And I'll show you something. This is the full moon in May. They come out on the full moon. They don't worry about the moon afterwards, but it's the full moon that they're worried about. So we can often fool ourselves if we don't consider all the possible sources of influence on what's going on. It's the full moon. I really should go back and look at Beebe's data and the full moon and see what's happening. Invasive species. We heard a lot about invasive species. We always hear a lot about invasive species from Tony. And invasive species certainly have had an effect on frog populations all over the world. Most famous, here's a study of mountain yellow-legged frogs in the Sierra Nevada, California, against rainbow trout. For a lot of wildlife managers, even today, a lake is not a lake unless it's got trout in it. If it doesn't have trout natively, you can always put trout in it, and then it's a proper lake. So if you put trout in one of these high mountain lakes where the frogs live, the trout eat the tadpoles, and the frogs disappear. If you're rotenoing out the trout, which is always fun, then the frogs come back. So there is resilience in the system, but they don't do very well against these invasive species. Now I have more students. I'm up to the end of the 90s, and the toads, they're going up. Remember that. Emerging diseases have been very heavily figured in the declining amphibian population business, particularly this disease called chytridiomycosis. I'm sure you might have heard about it. It's caused by a chytrid fungus. And when I went to school, went to university and took botany, we learned about chytrid fungi. And even the fungus guys in the botany department at UBC didn't know much about chytrids because they live in the soil and they just decompose things. And nobody knew anything about them. Now we know a lot about chytrids because of this one species of chytrid that makes its living by infesting the skin of amphibians rather than the soil, and it just eats them instead. And it is quite capable of turning a frog like this, this Mesotelopus, into a frog like that in a very short period of time, and it can be devastating. So people went to look to see if the what's the distribution of this pathogen, and if the pathogen is spreading, and if it is the global cause of amphibian demise everywhere and around the world. And it turns out that if you look for it, you find it everywhere. And it becomes, I think, not so much the a case of an invasive, devastating pathogen, as a classic epidemiological problem. You have an endemic pathogen, and it produces epidemics for particular reasons, someplace or another. And that's something we haven't really figured out or come to grips with. Usually there's some disturbance or stresses that enable a pathogen, any kind of endemic pathogen, to increase in prevalence so you get an epidemic. So we've seen epidemics. There are no documented epidemics of chytridiomycosis in Canada. There may have been one in the 70s affecting leopard frogs around Lake Manitoba, but no samples were ever taken, and so we really don't know. And that was before the chytrid itself was ever established or found or identified. So we have no history of this disease going back beyond the late 90s. We don't know. We don't know if it's new or if it's been around for a very long time. Finally, habitat destruction, which is the grill in the corner of the room, and it's everywhere. I can show you some local examples of habitat destruction. Habitat destruction is the hardest one of these to really pinpoint because it's everywhere, and it certainly is almost always our fault, and people hate that. This is very close by. This is the habitat of western chorus frogs, just on the south shore in Boucherville. And they lived in this little swampiness around in here, which became a subdivision a number of years ago. No more frogs. And for fowler toads, they live on the beaches of Lake Erie and along the Niagara Peninsula. There are some places where cars are allowed on the beach, set up volleyball nets. And, of course, you have to drive to the volleyball net before you can play volleyball. And the cars turn a toad like that into a toad like that without much trouble. So what is the cause of amphibian decline, we can ask? And I think we're coming to terms in the amphibian community that all these things are involved in the decline of amphibians. And there's no one neutron bomb of amphibian death. It's all of these things in context. What is the context and what is the place and what is the actual factor that is involved in perturbing amphibian abundance, which leads me now to right back to my continuing story, because now I can wrap it up for you. So now I have a whole lot of students. They're taking it easy. They should be out catching toads. And you might note the negative correlation between the number of students and the abundance of toads. This is something we could correlate that. And it may be a cause of global amphibian decline, is the number of students, but I doubt it. So we have now this pattern. And remember the definition in the sort of research program that I started with. We want to know what's normal, and we want to know what's a decline. And so I have this long data series. Can we actually, do I have enough to be able to understand and satisfy even that definition of what a decline is? So in order to do this, there are a number of tests that you can do. And one of them is devised by Benedict Schmidt in Switzerland, that rather than testing to see if there's a trend, you can test to see if there's no trend, which is an easier way of going about things. If there is no trend to your data set, then if you take the rate of increase, which is R, and you plot that against the estimated abundance of your animals, you should get a return point. You should get a significant negative correlation, and there should be some point right around here where R equals zero that crosses that line, and that's your return point, which tells you that if it goes up, they'll go down. And if they go down, they'll come up, and they'll come back to that return point. And over the whole number of years, it seems to satisfy this condition. In other words, I have no evidence of trend in this data set as a whole. However, if I look to see that it satisfies some theory of density dependence, either the Ricker model, which is linear, or the Gompertz model, which is logarithmic, I don't get, over the whole 24 years, I don't get almost, but not quite, a significant relationship. So one of these tests tells me that they return to a return point that might be regulated. And this one tells me, no, I don't have enough to say so. It is actually very, very difficult to prove density dependence in any population. It's only been shown in a few populations of sheep and deer off the coast of Scotland, where every animal is tagged for 50 years. So I don't want to do that. What I want to be able to try to show is if I've had a change from some dynamic that looks like normal regulation to something that doesn't. So with an analysis of this whole data series, look for a breakpoint. We can find a breakpoint. It's right about here, beyond which the population seems to be going down, and in front of which the population seems to be going up and down. So let's try those two tests again. In the first 13 years, there's a return point, very nice and clear. It seems to be conformed to some sort of regulation. Over the last 10 years, it does not. There is, therefore, no evidence of no trend in them. So it corresponds to what we might expect to see if there was a trend. And if we do the other test, looking for density dependence, we do get a significant confirmation to the Gompertz, the logarithmic model for density dependence, but we don't thereafter. There, look at that. So I have a culprit. I have a culprit is this reed. This is for Tony. It's an invasive species that has infested the marshes at Long Point. And a nice toad breeding pond like this in 93, turned 10 years later, turned into that. It's the same place, same time of year, from the same direction. I know, because I took those pictures. And really, the change is quite dramatic. It started to have its effect, and around that time, there's no correlation between toad abundance and frag abundance before then, but there really is afterwards. It's really quite significant. But this itself is not really true, because it's a step function. Once the phragmites has taken out all the breeding sites, then the toads are going to go down, because there's no place else to breed. And the models that we can devise for this is published last year, all show for the whole set of data, show that abundance and the plant are what determine, are the best models for determining what was going on. But for the first part of this term, it's only the abundance that seems to do anything, which is consistent with density dependence. But afterwards, there's nothing except lake level, which I think is spurious. And if we take those models overall, and we models parameterized over the whole data set, they do match the whole data set, models parameterized only over the first 13 years completely fail to predict the rest of it. So there has been a change in the dynamics of the population. They've gone from whatever they were doing before, which I presume is normal, to something else. And that something else is a decline. And I think that we have identified a plausible culprit for this decline. And so that indicates that there is a possible remedy for what's going on in this population. If we can either get rid of all the reeds, which seems to be impossible, or recreate the breeding sites that the reeds have obliterated. And we've done exactly that. With Kenny Wildlife Service, I persuaded them to dig these ponds in the marshes. Here's where they are in late spring. We're growing tadpoles in these pens. And these are new ones just dug last month in Long Point Provincial Park by Ontario Parks that we will investigate as well. So cool, because you can see these on Google Earth. You can see the ponds from space. And you can see them, they're here. There's these little, they're each double. So you can see these little rectangles. Those are the experimental ponds that were dug. And so I hope they work, because then, for the first time, I think uniquely, we'll be able to show a change in dynamics from normal to decline, and then bring them back up and actually recover them. And this will have implications. If you can do that for these guys, you could do that for others and try to bring back frogs and understand exactly why they've gone down and how you can bring them back. So that's my hope. And maybe we can satisfy this kind of research program that demands so much of us and takes so much time. But I think we're getting there. I have lots of people to thank, including the toads and all the students. And that's it. Thank you, Tony.